Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to everybody the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, April 10, 2015. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. And having a little technical difficulties here. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, coming to you live with a very special show today. On April 13th, 2014, Michael C. Rupert, who needs no introduction to most people listening to this show, took his own life following his last hosting of the Lifeboat Hour that night. I had the honor of being one of his last guests, along with Mimi Gurman. And today we're going to speak with someone who was very close to Mike and who wrote a book about his life, Jenna Orkin. And she and I, because we both worked closely with Mike, are going to talk about that book and share some of our experiences regarding our connection with Mike. I've also spoken on Facebook with Jessie Ray, who was Mike's partner, and I've encouraged her to call in during the show. We'll be taking calls in probably the last 20 minutes of the show, so I'm hoping we'll hear from Jessie Ray and from anyone else who would like to call in and ask a question or make a comment. The number here, as always, is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So my guest today, Jenna Orkin, lives in Manhattan and is a journalist whose work has been published at websites such as Counterpunch and Music and Vision Daily, among other places. She's the co-founder of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization. She started researching and writing for Mike's former website, From the Wilderness, in 2004, which eventually led to her book, Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert, and she's the author of A Moron's Guide to Collapse. Jenna and Mike were very close, and while few people can say they knew him well, I think Jenna can certainly say that, and that's why I invited her today to be on the show. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Jenna, or maybe I should say welcome back, because I don't know if you've been on the show before or not. Have you?
Yeah, Mike interviewed me once, and thank you so much, Carolyn.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here today. And I think the first place for us to start is to talk about how you met Mike and tell us about that experience and some of your first conversations with him.
All right. We met at the anniversary of the attacks in 2004, the third anniversary, and I'd been working on the environmental disaster that had ensued as a consequence of 9/11 because my son had been a student in high school four blocks north of Ground Zero. So by working at that full-time, 24/7, I attended hearings at all levels of government, and I became versed in the numerous and subtle ways in which the government lies, ways that you would never know if you hadn't been there on the inside, such as in our case, you know, they would say they hadn't found asbestos, but they had used antiquated equipment that found one-ninth the amount found by independent contractors. They would use the wrong equipment in the wrong place, turning the fans in the wrong direction, or equipment that was intended for one kind of surface on another surface. You really had to do research to find this out, and it was never reported in the press. So when Mike and I were both, among other people, invited to speak at that anniversary, and I heard him, I understood that the lies that I'd been exposed to were just one piece of a much larger picture. And Mike's talk at that event, for anyone who was there, was quite galvanizing. So I went home, researched his website, became kind of drunk on the experience, sent From the Wilderness an article on the environmental aspect of it, which they published, and then learned what they were looking for and did research and provided it to them. Now, you asked about first conversations. That's ironic because our very first conversation was one in which I asked him He had spoken about Dick Cheney's involvement in 9/11. He hadn't spoken directly about the economy, but I had the feeling he would know the answer to a question that I'd been wondering about all my life. I said, they keep talking about economic growth. Can it keep growing forever? Yeah. And he jumped, you know, he skyrocketed, hit the ceiling. He said, no, that's the whole problem. That's the root of it all. And, of course, that was the key, the cornerstone of his philosophy, and it's absolutely true that we have an economic paradigm based on interest, which requires infinite growth, an infinitely expanding population on a finite planet.
Right, and he was so fond of saying, until you change the way money works, you change nothing, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about From the Wilderness, the awesome, amazing website that Mike created over the course of, I don't know how many years, 10, 12 years, something like that,
yeah.
Yeah. And I'd like you to talk about some of the most important articles that Mike ever published on that site. Let's take plenty of time for this.
All right. It's a unique and unduplicated website. I mean, there are other 9/11 research websites that are invaluable also, but this one has its own place. Some of my standout articles that, you know, my favorites are Global Corp, which he published in around 2005. It was also one of his favorites.
That's one of the most amazing articles he ever wrote. I agree.
Yeah, and it's really quite terrifying when you read it, and you understand that the course of corporations, which is to merge bigger and bigger and, you know, dominate, coincides with the course of the destruction of the Earth. It has to.
Right.
It may not be what they want, but it is inevitable. That's a must-read.
For a second, I just want to make sure people understand the title of that. It's Global Corp, Global C-O-R-P. It's all one word, right?
Yes.
And that people can just Google that, Global Corp, Mike Rupert, and you'll probably be taken to From the Wilderness, and there you can read that amazing article.
Yeah. Another one that I loved was about Bobby Kennedy, in which he points out the parallels between, you know, his background in Los Angeles and the assassination of Kennedy, in which he names the real assassin and says, somebody sue me, please, let's go to court. He had the documentation. He had interviewed the relevant people. He's spoken to Bobby Kennedy, I don't want to, you know, misstate the case. It provides unique information that you can't get anywhere else.
Do you recall the title of that article?
Something, Bobby, We Never Knew, or We Never Knew You, or something
okay.
like that. Then another one that is critical for the information the government had leading up to 9/11 is Lucy, You Got a Lot of Splain to Do. And in that one, he lays out the key articles that had been published prior to 9/11, which show that the government had every reason, at least, to suspect something that was going to happen. The title, of course, is an allusion to the I Love Lucy show, which
right.
was a favorite of his era. So he was very proud of the Pat Tillman series, in which he and Stan Goff went to the house of Pat Tillman's mother, Mary Tillman, and acquired documents, and I remember being on the phone with him as he was doing it, which proved the friendly fire and the suppression of that information by Donald Rumsfeld and other generals. That the articles that Stan Goff wrote about that were then used by Congress in an investigation of Pat Tillman's death and the suppression of the information about it. So Mike was extremely proud of that. He also felt at one time, though I think he changed his tune, he felt that that article was the reason for the debacle at the end of From the Wilderness and the reason that the 7 computers were smashed and the website, you know, met its demise.
Well, he also attributed he also attributed the dismissal, or not dismissal, but the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld to that article series, because
yes,
he felt that Rumsfeld got nailed by that. And I remember in 2008 he sent me a copy of the Pat Tillman book with the address of Mary, his mother, and Mary and I corresponded for a while, and I wrote an article for my website on the incident. So
yeah,
that was just a stellar experience when he was living in Ashland, and he and Stan Goff worked on that.
Right.
Yeah. So here's a really important question for you, Jenna. Why do you think Mike was so uniquely able to do what he did?
Oh, he was the right man in the right place at the right time. Why was he the right man? He was the son of, on his father's side, you know, the Lockheed Martin employee who worked on, I'm not good at this, but some kind of satellite. And on his mother's side, the NSA cryptanalyst. So
mm-hmm.
he had inside information on the workings of the intelligence agencies and of the technology, you know, the cutting-edge Internet sort of technology, so that he was able to understand how the government worked from the inside. Then, on the other side, he was also a Hollywood baby, and this cuts both ways. I think this was his undoing, as well as his, you know, one of the reasons he was as so advanced in PR understanding as he was. Being a Hollywood baby, he understood what he called Jungian archetypes. I think that's slightly elevated. I think it's more Hollywood stereotypes. But he understood how to reach the American people and the popular culture. He understood how to express himself in a way that didn't turn them off. There are many people who had the knowledge that he had, but they would be too dry, too academic, and he tempered it just enough to capture their imaginations and their guts without taking it too far. So he had the information, and he also had the ability to package it. That was fantastic.
It really was. That was just amazing the way he did that. Now, your close association with Mike led you to write two books. Of course, the one is about his life, but you also wrote, I forget which year, A Moron's Guide to Collapse. Can you tell us a bit about that book?
Yeah, The Moron's Guide to Global Collapse. That has Mike's fingerprints all over it, and I, you know, give him credit all over the place. That book intends to be a kind of one-stop shopping center for people who have just woken up to the fact that the way the world works is not what they've been led to believe and not what they've been told and not what they grew up being educated in. So if you start putting together the assassinations and the troubling way that they're not sufficiently investigated and the troubling way in which the Bush family gets implicated, you know, in the Hinckley assassination attempt of Reagan and in the Kennedy assassination, Bushes are present, and God knows they had been working business partners of the Osama bin Laden family. Isn't that an odd, you know, course of events?
Yes, indeed.
When you start piecing those things together and economic crises and the way the economy works and interest, fiat currency, fractional reserve banking, the way the media plays up certain aspects and manages to ignore others, you either go nuts on the Internet, which will lead you down dead ends. It will lead you towards Alex Jones and David Icke, and there
mm-hmm.
you will just, you know, spend
right.
your days with the lunatic fringe.
Exactly.
So my book intends to be a kind of a primer to set you in the right direction. It, God knows it doesn't cover everything, but it will set you towards the websites that are more likely to be helpful, and it intends to make it as simple as possible. Mike and his cohort, such as Jim Kunstler, were, as you've been saying, stellar representatives, but they speak to a rather informed audience.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know about the issue just to find them.
Right.
And then to listen through it to the details, you have to know what they're talking about. My book is intended for people who don't know what they're talking about. It's for the teen, the high school kids, the mm-hmm. college kids, you know, who grew up taking in as mother's milk the media line one way or another. So it's, I tried to make it as simple as possible.
Well, you certainly did a great job with it, and I want to thank you for that book because it really is a basic primer for what people need to know.
Thank you so much. And by the way, thank you for your extraordinary work, which people will never appreciate enough, in From the Wilderness and in Mike's life throughout.
Thank you for that, Jenna. In a moment, we're going to hear a song, and, you know, along about 2009, I think Mike got involved with a band called New White Trash. He was involved as a vocalist for the band, and he often played New White Trash clips on this show. In fact, Avalanche and Earthquake was the New White Trash song that Mike chose as the theme for this show. Let's listen to it now.
Okay.
that was Avalanche and Earthquake by New White Trash, the band with which Mike was involved for about 4-5 years before he left us. And this is the Lifeboat Hour. And I'm Carolyn Baker, trying to be the host that Mike would have wanted me to be when he asked me to take over this show. And later in the show, we're going to be taking calls, and the number again is 888-874-4888. You know, during the song, I was thinking about the fact that Mike was one of the giants on whose shoulders we stand as we do the work that we do. And you, Jenna, as a journalist, and me doing the work I'm doing, all of us carrying on his legacy in our own way. He was a catalyst for so many things. And one of the reasons that he named this show the Lifeboat Hour was that he knew that in addition to collapse and catastrophic climate change, there are lifeboats that we all need to step into in order to process the gory details of what's happening. And one of the commitments I have in doing this show is to invite people on the show to talk about how we're creating those lifeboats and how we can process our predicament, accept it, and find love and support from each other. So your great contribution, Jenna, has been your book on collapse and your fabulous biography of Mike.
Thank you so much.
You bet. And, Jenna, I'd like you to talk about Mike's early life and how it influenced him to do the work that he did and how it may also have been the source of lifelong depression. What I don't want to do is to start a long psychological evaluation of Mike. His emotional turmoil was not unique to Mike. We are all, and I emphasize all, deeply wounded emotionally, if for no other reason than we grew up in this culture. Some of us find healing and wholeness and find ways to navigate ourselves in a soul-murdering culture, and others do not. Millions of people develop suicidal ideation, as Mike had for most of his adult life. Some people live with that ideation and do not take their lives. Others can't live with it and act on the compulsion to kill themselves. So, Jenna, if you would, please tell us your thoughts on Mike's early life and what you witnessed in his lifelong struggle with depression.
Okay. I would like to take a step back from calling the book a biography because it attempts to be a memoir of my time mostly when he lived with me for 14 months in New York.
Right.
Were I to do a biography, I would have had to interview his cousins and people who knew. None of that took place. So focuses as a memoir, which is a much more humble endeavor. So why was he, what is it in his background that made him able to do what he did? I think it's partly that he was extremely competitive, and that is a good thing and a bad thing, so you achieve a lot, but, you know, it also alienated some people.
Mm-hmm.
His strong desire to be a hero. When he was in the police force, there was a colleague called Jim Jacquette who died, I guess, in action and had 2,000 people at his funeral. And Mike said, you know, he wanted to have a funeral like that. And I think he would have been gratified by the response that his death did get. But, you know, that's a very contorted kind of way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So... again, going back to the Hollywood background, he thought in terms of movie, how this is going to play out. I once had a professor in law school who said, be your own hero, be the hero of your own novel. And I think Mike was trying to do that. People were always saying to him, you know, Anthony Hopkins should play you in the movie Made of Your Life, or Philip Seymour Hoffman, which I thought was a great idea, should be Mike. And I think that the thought that his life would become a movie was not alien to him at all.
Right.
And it did become a movie. It became a fantastic movie called Collapse.
Yes.
With all the irony involved in that title, both his own personal collapse, the global collapse, and how the one reflects the other. So I think his Hollywood background with the impetus to be a hero was very important. And I also think that there's something about people who are personally on the edge, and that's a lot of us. I'm not saying, you know, pointing a finger at him, that enables us to see the ways in which the world is screwed up. You have to be an eccentric outside the center to see that things, you know, all is not well in the state of Denmark. If you're squarely in the center, oh, I love that metaphor. If you're right in the center and you're doing well in it and you're at the top of the world and you're functioning on Wall Street and everybody thinks that you're the greatest for that, you have no incentive to question the way things are. But but he placed himself elsewhere, which is where heroes come from. And so I think that, you know, you have to be on the outside.
Absolutely.
To accomplish what he did.
Yes.
There's no question about that. And then the lifelong depression, well, there are several things. One is being declared, when you're born, being declared dead on arrival is a little bit unusual and perhaps reflects in the rest of your life, not, of course, that you're aware that they did that. You don't know what the words mean, but it will affect the way your parents treat you and, you know, and then I'm not going to speculate anymore, but God knows what that does to you physically. Then going on from there, he came from a background in which incest played a part.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the memories that he had of it were brought up during hypnosis, which is not entirely trustworthy. So we don't know what happened, but something happened, in fact, more than one thing. There were things that he did consciously remember, not related to his mother, but a family he spent a lot of time with where there was intergenerational incest and within generations and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that can screw with your mind.
It certainly can.
Yeah. And substance abuse also. There was a family history of some of that.
Right, right. You know, I want to say, as you are saying this, something that I was going to say at the beginning of the show, it kind of slipped me, but I want to say that it is really important that when we remember someone or eulogize them, that we not idealize them. And as I said a moment ago, all of us are wounded, broken human beings. And, you know, none of us likes to go to a movie where all of the characters are either all good or all bad. You know, we find that boring. The same with a novel. And in any good story, we have good characters, rich characters, who are a mix of everything. We're complicated, complex human beings. So, you know, one of the things I appreciate about your book is that, you know, your memoir is that you really show us the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything in between about Michael C. Rupert. And I think that is extremely important, and that is certainly the way I want to remember him and speak of him, because to do otherwise, I believe, is a huge disservice to him. Does that make sense?
I agree with that you don't do him any good by setting him on a pedestal and saying, you know, he was a Christ-like figure who died to save the world or something like that, because it only attracts enemies who say, well, what about this and that? So you have to incorporate all of it.
Absolutely. So I want to go back to Sunday night, April 13th, 2014, and play another song shortly. Before Mike dialed up PRN that night to begin the lifeboat hour, he had everything in place to take his life. Several notes were written to various people, leaving instructions about how to proceed after his death. Among those instructions was one for me, asking me to take over the lifeboat hour and keep the same name for the show. Mike clearly knew that that would be his last show, and at the time, neither Mimi Gurman nor I, who were guests on the show, or anyone listening, could have predicted or guessed that Mike was saying goodbye. But from hindsight, many of us put the pieces together, especially when we re-listened to this song that he played on that show by Jane Seabury and K.D. Lang, Calling All Angels.
Santa Teresa, Santa Anna, Santa Susanna, Santa Cecilia, Santa Cordelia, Santa Domenica, Mary Angelica, Frater Ashes, Frater Pietro, Julianus, Petronella, Santa Santos.
and a baby cries. High above you can hear the church bell start to ring. And as the heaviness, oh, the heaviness, the body settles in, somewhere you can hear a mother sing. Then it's one foot, then the other, as you step out on the road. Step out on the road. How much weight? How much? Then it's how long and how far and how many times. Oh, before it's too late. Call all angels, call all angels. Walk me through this one, don't leave me. It's almost as if you could only crack the code, then you'd finally understand what this all means. Ah, but if you could, do you think you would trade it all the pain and suffering? But then you'd miss the beauty of the light upon this earth, and then the sweetness of the leaving. Calling all angels, calling all angels, walk me through this one, don't leave me alone.
Calling All Angels, sung by Jane Seabury and Katie Lang. And it was the last song played by Mike Rupert on this show on April 13th, 2014, a few minutes before he took his life. This time as I listened, I was struck by this verse, "Ah, but if you could, do you think you would trade in all the pain and suffering? Ah, but then you'd miss the beauty of the light upon this earth and the sweetness of the leaving." And I have to say that for much of his adult life, Mike was obsessed with the sweetness of the leaving. And finally, the unbearable sweetness of leaving became too much to resist. In a few minutes, we're going to begin taking callers as we remember the life of Mike Rupert and his death on April 13, 2014. If you have a comment or question, please call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Today I'm talking with Jenna Orkin, who was a close friend of Mike's and who, after his death, wrote Scout,
a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert. Well, you know, there's never one overriding reason why anyone commits suicide. For every suicide, there's a long and convoluted story. And as I look back at Mike's childhood, and I have my own theories about some of the wounding that scarred him for the rest of his life, I recall his struggle with addictions, and that's a whole other piece of the puzzle. There was the work he'd been doing as a whistleblower and cultural critic since the 1970s, doggedly swimming upstream against empire. And having spoken with him many times in the last week of his life, it's now clear to me from hindsight that he was beyond weary with all of it, and the weight of what he was carrying was more than he could bear. He perceived his suicide as a sacrifice, the sacrifice of a fallen warrior for his fellow comrades in the struggle. And Jenna, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why he killed himself.
I don't want to speculate about that. It almost seems too easy. You know, history is written by the winners, and the history of a suicide would be written by the survivors. So I think he had, as I wrote to you in an email, he had a rendezvous with death. I mean, it had been on his mind as long as I'd known him. And when he lived with me, the entire 14 months, well, no, okay, the first several months were simply a negotiation to keep him from doing it. And even when he was in Venezuela, our conversations on the phone were to keep him from doing it. It sounds bizarre, but it was possible. He knew enough about physics to know that. He was going to hang himself from the shower fixture, and I'm sure he decided that that was not really the way he wanted to go. But he was going to kill himself in Venezuela. He was going into dangerous neighborhoods and hoping somebody would say, your money or your life. He wrote that. And at my house, you know, he would go and smoke on the roof and case the joint up there, and he once walked, he was looking out the window, and he walked away muttering to himself, don't tell them when or where. It really was, well, I don't know, he was theatrical, so it was probably for my benefit also, but he really was going to do it. All his psychiatrists thought there was a real danger. They hospitalized him because of it. He hospitalized himself because of it. So, you know, it's almost like as though the question was, why didn't he do it earlier?
That's a
and
really
thank
good
God
point,
he didn't
it?
Do it on my watch. Oh, thank you, Mike, for that.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, Jenna, we have a caller. Mayat in New York is calling. Go ahead, Mayat.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, all. I'm really enjoying the program, particularly since just before the big event in terms of Mike's transition, I had a sort of serendipitously discovered him on PRN on the phone, so I had been, of course, looking forward for further of that connection. And I want to share that when I first heard of it, I, you know, because of the work that he did, I first thought, well, was it a suicide? Because, of course, I hear people talking about Gary Webb's suicide, although he was shot twice in the head. So this program is very hardening, I guess, in the sense that it's a great loss, and I extend condolences to, you know, his family and those close to him. But I guess it is helpful to know that this was someone that we did lose through a suicide, and that we have to be more protective, perhaps, if there's anything we can do. I find that the world is very rejecting of each other, and, you know, it's such a scramble to have community. A question that I have, because I had to step away at a point, and I didn't get the full details on, I understand there's a book collapse and a movie, so if Jenna would make sure we have her full name and spelled if possible, you know, if relevant, and also about the movie, which I didn't hear about, and the availability of the book for book people. Okay, and I'll listen over the air if you have my questions.
Thank you so much, Mariette, for calling. Yeah, go ahead, Jenna. Wants to know about the book, the movie, how to get in touch with all of that, and you are Jenna Orkin, O-R-K-I-N, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, his movie, the one in which he is the main, really the only character, is called Collapse. It was directed by Chris Smith, who also directed The Yes Men. And it's a 2009 film, but you can find it on the Internet. And it's an extraordinary movie, very educational. Mike wrote a book called, it is called, no, Confronting Collapse, but that's not what the caller meant. Mike's most renowned book is called Crossing the Rubicon, and it's well worth reading. My book is called Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert. So the word is Scout, S-C-O-U-T, because it's a reference to what journalists do. They go out ahead of everybody else, and it's how he referred to himself in one of his suicide notes also. Thank you, caller.
Yes, thank you so much, caller. And anyone else, you know, the lines are open here, 888-874-4888. If you have a question or a comment for Jenna, would love to hear from you. And I'd like you, Jenna, to tell us a little bit more about your book, Scout. You published huge chunks of it online last year following Mike's death. But what motivated you to write it, and why should we read it?
Okay. When Mike was living with me, the first 2 weeks, two or three, were terribly intense, and I thought, God, I would love to make notes. But I knew that he would balk at that, and the last thing he wanted was to feel in that vulnerable state that he was under a microscope or there was a camera pointing at him. So I didn't broach it. But after about 3 weeks, when he started to get acclimated, I mean, he hated New York, and he hated my apartment, and he was all he could do to avoid hating me. But anyway, he kind of got mellowed a bit, and I asked him if I could make notes, and he said okay. But it was very clear he didn't want me sitting there with a notepad, much less a tape recorder, and I was to be discreet about it, but he knew that I was doing it. And in fact, when he left my apartment, he took a copy of the notes that he found on the computer. So I kept notes by remembering his conversations and then going to the computer afterwards and writing them up while they were still fresh. And I did it as faithfully and as verbatim as I could, which of course is very far from complete, but there's a lot of information there which I would have forgotten, and I regret the loss of the first 3 weeks. So that's how I had the notes. And so I knew that one day they'd be a book, and I actually thought it would be published while he was still alive, of course. But that didn't happen. So when he died, there was an enormous amount of speculation on the net, and it was, as it always is on the net, reasonable but uninformed and sometimes insane and sometimes ill-willed and all kinds of things. And particularly for his fans, who felt absolutely bereft, I felt that information would at least lay some questions to rest and would at least give them something tangible to hold on to. So I started writing, and I, you know, formed the notes in such a way into bite-sized daily missives, and put them at mikerupert.blogspot.com, and also they were published on collapsenet.com,
mm-hmm.
and then on some Facebook pages. And as people responded, some positively and God knows some negatively, the positive ones impelled me to do more faster. It was quite inspiring. So, you know, I worked quite feverishly, and you were one of the first recipients of each.
Yes, I was.
You know, each installment. And almost the entire book is available on the net. It is not a money-making enterprise.
Where can people find that, Jenna?
MikeRupert.blogspot.com. It's also somewhere, I would assume that CollapseNet has archived it somewhere, but I'm not sure. Yeah. They certainly published all of it. Everything is at MikeRupert.blogspot.com except for the last installment, which is in the book alone. It's interesting, but you can certainly get an awful lot of the story, about 99% of it, from the website.
Jenna, we have another caller. Peter is calling in. Peter, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for doing the show. I'm wondering how the investigative journalism has become such a powerful space now. What do you know about Mike's early, how it came about for him early, and what role you think it plays nowadays with so many people, well, even like yourselves, doing the investigative journalism?
Carolyn,
why don't you go ahead, Jenna, because I met Mike in 2000, and I believe he started publishing from the Wilderness in, 78, shortly
no,
after
he left? I think it was later than that. I think it was in the 90s, because what happened was that in the 70s, I'm not going to do arithmetic right now, but when he was about 28, he had an enormous falling out with the Los Angeles Police Department, where he'd been promoted and got stellar recommendations. But he uncovered the CIA dealing drugs. This is all very well documented. It's all on the net, and probably most listeners are all too familiar with it. So he reported to the LAPD what he discovered, and he found, to his surprise, that they were not on his side. And so he ran afoul of them, and he was forced to leave the force, which was a tremendous tragedy for him, and also his engagement broke up. And that's very much related, because she was trying to lure him into the CIA.
Well, she was CIA, right?
Yeah, she was. Then he had years of floundering one job to another, working in a gun store, fixing audio systems, UPS driver. That's where he met his hypnotist, who uncovered the memories of early childhood incest. And then he surfaced, and he was also a security guard at the Academy Awards and escorted Vanessa Redgrave when she gave her historic speech, which he then said inspired, well, he wrote to her in an inscription of Crossing the Rubicon. He wrote that that inspired him to write the book. Okay, it's a bit florid, but I'm sure there's something to it. And we presented that to her backstage when we went to see her performing in New York. We didn't get to meet her directly. She said she wanted to, and then she got cold feet.
Peter, I'm wondering, are we answering your question? Is there something else in that question you want us to tackle?
Well, he wants to know about the investigative journalism.
Right.
And so what happened in the 90s, I believe, was that Mike started writing his interpretation of events. He sent it out to about 68 people. They liked it. He said, if you like it, send me $25, and I'll keep doing it. And that happened. And then this subscription base grew enormously to tens of thousands.
He had about 20,000 subscribers, I believe, in 2006.
Yeah, and about 30 or more were offices in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, they were. Yeah, so, Peter, are you still there?
I am still here, and yes, what I wanted was some of that background, but then now to kind of move it forward to now, where it feels like he played quite the early leadership role in daring people to come out and speak out, and that just seems like such a rich part of what's happening these days.
It absolutely is. And you know, Jenna and Peter, I was thinking today, I was thinking, what would Mike be writing about and screaming about with all of this police brutality, with the racism that is just, you know, exuding everywhere in law enforcement? You know, I'm sure he would have some incredible articles to write about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember his being very concerned with those incidents at Katrina.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
right, and then the whole topic of climate change and how this is coming on us so quickly.
Yes.
Just begging for people to speak out about.
Yes, he absolutely was. During the last year or so of his show, he was very much involved with this issue. And, you know, he had Guy McPherson on a couple of times, I believe, and he talked about it very frequently. Thank you, Peter, for calling in. Is there anyone else who would like to call in? 888-874-4888. We'd love to hear from you with a comment or question for Jenna Orkin. And while we're waiting, Jenna, if you could, tell us a little bit more about the Moran's Guide to Collapse, because it just sounds like such a really important basic book, kind of like a the first step in learning about collapse and beginning to think about how to prepare.
Right. That's what it's intended to do. I'm told that it has a wry sense of humor, which is also intended.
That's so you.
either you go nuts with the tragedy of it, or you take a kind of a sardonic pleasure in the absurdity of it, and you have to step back from what you see going on around you,
right?
In order to maintain your sanity. So I've been told that it's presented humorously, not belly laughs or anything, but there's a great deal of irony in the way that, the government is so flagrant. They remind me of the bully in the schoolyard where they kick you and you're down, and then they say, "Oh, I'm sorry," and then they, kick you in the head. "Oh, did that hurt? Oh, I'm so sorry." And another one. The government is taunting us to say, I guess I'm not allowed to say this on your show, but what the F?
Right, right.
And yet people are becoming more and more docile. Not all people, of course. I think there is a heartening resurrection of rebellion around the world, and some of it is a little scary because they just want to, as in the French Revolution, they just want to kill, cut off his head, whoever he is. I guess the book is intended to say, primarily, as Mike used to say, we're all collectively guilty. We're all responsible. Look at the oppressor in the mirror. We condemn Marie Antoinette for being so uninformed about what her people were going through. We are infinitely worse than Marie Antoinette.
Oh, absolutely.
We live in a society that is equivalent to having 400 slaves per person. We take it for granted. We don't see the slaves. We don't see the people jumping out the window at Foxconn in China. Those are our slaves. They're all over the world. So if the book were to teach any lesson at all, it would be that there are no easy answers, and reform has to be radical in the sense of from the root.
Well, Jenna, listening to you, I'm just wondering why you're not writing more books, for God's sake.
Oh, I am. Don't worry.
Okay.
Three so far, two political, one not. There will be more.
Okay, very, very good. How can people get in touch with you if they want to connect?
Well, I'm on Facebook. If you want to connect, please somehow send me a clue that you're not going to be advertising sunglasses. That gets so tedious. My email is jennakilt@aol.com Kilt is not my name. Never was. it's just the stupidity of trying to get an address.
Well, it is an email address I have never, ever forgotten in all of the time that I've known you. So, you're not in my address book, but you're in my head.
That's much better.
I thank you so much, Jenna Orkin, for being on the show today. It's been a pleasure to visit with you here and just to ask you some questions publicly that I haven't been able to ask you before. I so admire your two books that are out now, and look forward to many, many more coming from you. You're such an articulate and prolific writer and speaker, and I'm so glad you're with us.
Thank you, and the same to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you all listeners for being with us today. We'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the